cliffcentral.com.
All right, I'm very excited to speak to Abed Ahmed, who's here with us now. He's actually been in radio in South Africa for some time already, and he is living in... You're in Turkey at the moment, or are you out here on holiday?
I'm out here on holiday. I'm holidaying in my own country.
I know.
Yeah.
So, dude, it's nice to see you. It's nice to meet you. Abed has been the former digital editor at Eyewitness News, former senior field reporter and web editor at Caxton CTP Publishers and Printers, former morning news anchor and senior field reporter at Radio Islam International, and former sports reporter at South African Press Association. Plenty of other jobs, too, that you have, actually.
Well, 15 years, eh?
I know, dude. This is some CV you got here.
Well, you know, I started off 15 years ago, got my big break, and then, yeah, as I say, the rest is history. I just built my way up, focused on my career, and continued moving forward.
Abed, I'm interested in a lot of things. One of the things that I heard from Dari when we were busy deciding on people, really interesting people we wanted to meet this year, was that you are living in Turkey. And as I mentioned before, Turkey is really at the nexus of a lot of things that are geopolitically important right now.
Absolutely critical. I mean, the location of Turkey, I mean, you got Syria, as you mentioned earlier on the eastern side with Iraq as well. You got Russia above it. It's basically the gateway between Asia and Europe.
And it is trying to make friends with both sides. It's trying to hold its own in terms of sovereignty. It's got a president who's sort of dictator for life, if you look at the signs right now.
Well, I mean, there's two sides of the coin on it. I mean,
we'll get into him just now. Give us the more general scenario. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
All right, cool. So basically, I mean, this is when I moved there. I mean, I had a certain perception of Turkey. Yeah. People used to tell me, okay, you know, it's an Islamic country and you'll be fine and everything's
good.
It's
a secular country, right? Actually.
Extremely mixed. It's quite diverse. You've got a big Jewish population of Turks. You've got a large Christian population of Turks, and then the Muslim population living side by side. And then obviously the atheists, who are the ultra nationalists. There are a lot of atheists, the Kemalists, and like that, they pride themselves on their secularism. A few quarters here and there are very Islamic dominated, quite conservative. But in retrospect, Istanbul itself is like a melting pot of different religions. Different cultures, people from around the world are coming there. I mean, this was at one time, Constantinople was like the capital of the Ottoman Empire, and it was the boiling pot of civilization, basically. And well, now, once again, that's what they're trying to recreate, basically.
Fill in for me where I leave things out. But it used to be called Asia Minor. It used to be part of the Eastern Roman Empire. Constantinople,
yes,
which became Istanbul, was Byzantium before then.
Yes.
And Byzantium was the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire. It was where Constantine the Great put the Bible together at the Council of Nicaea. It's where you had stories that are written in many of the holy books happen. It was also the site of places like Ephesus and, you know, sort of ancient Greek, ancient Roman, and later on Phoenician, Israeli Jewish, Roman, later on Eastern Orthodox Empire, a lot of Orthodox Christianity for a long time there, the Hagia Sophia, very well-known tourist destination. But I mean, this is a place that is so colorful, so interesting, so diverse, but it's just recently become a bit of a political hotbed. What are the current strains?
Well, currently, I wouldn't say recently. I'd say Turkey's been in the hot seat for quite a while now. I mean, because of its geopolitical location.
Yeah.
They've always had issues when it came to the PKK terrorist group from Atatürk's time. Because they were looking...
He was the founder of modern Turkey.
Basically, right? Yeah, Mustafa Kemal. And basically, the Kurds wanted their independence, and the Ottoman Empire had expanded and had taken them in. And that was it. No one was going to be giving them the independence. They continued fighting for years and years and years. There's been bombings, you know, for generations, and there's been attacks for generations, and it's still continuing until today. More recently, we're looking at newer threats. We're looking at ISIS. We're looking at, those type of influences coming in and people within the country itself. I mean, just last year, I had moved there early on in the year last year, and then a few months later, it was the failed coup, the coup attempt.
Yes. Was that a failed coup, or was it really just a pretend activity by the incumbent government?
Well, according to me, I seen it firsthand. This was definitely a failed coup because, okay. I mean, I didn't know anything about Turkey at that time. I was relatively new to the country. And look, while it was all happening, I was out in the street doing live crossings, etc. And we met a few people and we spoke to soldiers who were part of this whole thing. And they knew exactly what they were doing. And they were taking orders from somebody. Hmm. You know, so, I mean, these type of things prove to us that, you know what, there was another force behind the whole thing.
It did give Erdogan a lot of room to clamp down.
I think he was lucky. I think he was lucky.
So?
I think he was very lucky. His support was dwindling.
Yeah.
After this, he gained so much of, like, at least like 30% more support. But now it's kind of dwindling again because he had increased the state of emergency to carry out all these raids and these blitzes and shutting down of companies and schools and getting rid of so-called FETÖ, Gulen terrorist group, you know, people who are within society he's trying to clamp down. So it basically gave him a free rein to do whatever he wanted to do and to rid the country of this. But the thing is that you mentioned earlier on, I mean, they are making friends with everybody and currently they are very, very, very close with Russia. Mm. And they've kind of turned their back to the EU and they're probably going to be signing with the Shanghai Pact, which is the new Asian version of the EU, basically, with the entire Eastern bloc of countries, which includes India, Pakistan.
It's the new Comintern, effectively.
You know, so it's basically East versus West.
Right.
I mean, that's basically...
We find ourselves back in the 1970s and 80s.
If you remember television back in the day, American propaganda television used to show us all these, you know, the Russian criminal or there's always East versus West. So that's going to be playing out. I mean, you can see it happening already and... Yeah, that's basically what's going on. It was really scary. I won't lie to you. I had never experienced anything like this in my life, obviously. From South Africa, I mean, we covered xenophobia. I was in the heart of things, covering stories all over South Africa, violent protests, whatever it was. I thought, you know what? I'd been through the mold.
Yeah, you're tough. You can
handle
this.
You know, we've been through the mold.
So why was it so insane?
So I was out in the street the night it was happening and I was doing live crossings and I live directly under the Bosphorus Bridge. My apartment is directly under the Bosphorus Bridge.
God.
And everything was happening above this bridge, Gareth. And while I was at the bottom, I promise you, scene out of a Chuck Norris movie. Picture this. Helicopter lowers down. Guy sitting with this massive 50mm cannon looking down on the bridge and he starts firing.
God.
We under the bridge, scattering, and these bullets are ricocheting down at the bottom to us. And I'm just standing there. I'm staring at this guy in the helicopter.
You're like,
up
I should have stayed
like,
in South Africa.
What the hell is? I was excited. My adrenaline was pumping. I was like, "Wow, look at this! My God, what the hell? Where am I?" And a few guys came. They were like, you know, hey, you know, they told me I'm crazy. They grabbed me and they put me behind the tree. And they're like, you know what, you know, just stay here. And I was trying to get shots and stuff like that. And then eventually I managed to get into my apartment. And it was a few minutes later that the jets flew overhead. And the sonic boom was so loud. It was done to scare off a lot of the people on the bridge. And that it basically rattled our entire apartment. We had crockery, cutlery, the TV fell. My kids, I didn't wake them up because they were like asleep. I left them asleep. They jumped out of their beds. It was crazy. Uh-huh. They were crying, Dad, what's going on? Daddy, 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 mommy, you know? And everybody started freaking out. Then everyone had come onto TV to call on the people to come back out on the streets and to retake the country, basically. And within 30 minutes, I mean, the loudspeaker systems on the mosques around Istanbul, the guys began calling for people to come out on the streets, you know, listen, take your country back, just God. I've never seen anything like this.
Hey, that's they use it only for the azan, but this time they managed to actually bring the people out.
And exactly. So I stood there on the balcony and I watched like hundreds of people, just women, old, young, children, people coming out in droves onto the streets, making their way up onto the Bosphorus Bridge. They're walking past my apartment, going up. And I was like, you know what, I cannot miss this. So out I went, told my wife and kids, listen, guys, I think you guys just hang around for a year. Mm. For now, you guys got to go back. If anything happens, they had the instructions. I went up. And
Is this during the day or night?
This is during the night.
Okay.
This was at night. This was when all the action was happening. And I went up well, halfway up.
This is like being in Tahrir Square in Egypt during those revolutions.
But I have to
only
ask
more then, violent, obviously.
You know, that wasn't an easy decision to make, to just leave your wife, leave your kids.
He's a reporter. He can't help himself.
My wife's used to it. I've been in media for 2 years. I'm married for 11, so she's...
He's like,
she
I'm
knows.
Missing out on a story. If anything happens to me, you guys can collect the medals.
And they're cool. It's like a game
they
plan.
Have they have the instructions. They have the go-bags, the passports, the or whatever. It's all done.
You're,
it's
just, you're a nutcase.
Yeah. They knew. We had contact with the embassy directly. I mean, the ambassador, Pule Malefani, was taking instructions from me, basically information from me, because I was out there. I was like his go-to man in Istanbul, because
he didn't know what was
going on. They in Ankara. Sure. They had no eyes in Istanbul, so they made me their eyes. We created a WhatsApp group of a whole lot of South Africans who were there in Turkey, in Istanbul and Ankara, and, you know, we were just sharing information.
Wow.
And just to say, guys, we're safe. This is what's happening. This is what's going on. I'm heading to the bridge now. This is, you know, so basically I was his go-to person, and I went up. So my wife was in contact with him, so she was, you know, sorted out. Just to answer your question. And I made my way up to the bridge. And I didn't even get to climb the bridge, because that's when they started opening fire on the people getting onto the bridge. And it was completely insane, because these soldiers, despite people saying that they didn't know where the instructions were coming from or they didn't know what they were doing, they began opening fire. You know, they started shooting with live ammunition against civilians and against their own people. So I seen it. That I witnessed. I seen it. And they started coming and people started fighting them. And it was crazy, because these are unarmed civilians with nothing.
Yeah.
And they're attacking guys with these M16s. You know, and look, I was like, you know what, I ain't going to risk myself, my life for this.
Yeah.
It's not even my country, number one. You know, I think I'm just going to go back to my apartment, just keep it safe for now. Because, you know, they were coming really close to where I was, and I made my way back down. But overall, very scary, extremely scary, but exciting for a journalist.
Yeah.
Next morning, I was at the office by 5 a.m., obviously because of what had happened, and the streets were dead. By 9 o'clock, everything was back to normal. By 9, 10 o'clock, buses were running. The ferry was running.
That's how a coup happens, huh?
It was like everything was completely, it was like as if nothing happened. By 1 o'clock, we were shopping.
But when?
I promise you, when by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, we were shopping.
When did you first hear from the president? When did you first know that the, you know, government was still in place? Because you couldn't have known that just from the activity.
Nothing. We basically kept on switching between the Turkish television news channels.
Mm.
And then we landed up on CNN Turk, because they had basically their camera people out in the streets. They were taking in live streams from civilians. They were taking a lot of live streams. And then Erdogan managed to get a hold of them, and he did the FaceTime call with them.
Hmm.
So we seen it live, and we seen it happen.
Wow.
And yeah, you seen me earlier on with my phone doing the whole, I use an app to translate a certain thing. So we held the phone in front of the television,
yeah,
you know, and it picks up the audio. So it basically gave us a little bit of what he was saying. So then we knew he was fine. The government was still there, and, you know, they were trying to regain control of the country, basically.
What an incredible thing to witness.
And not only that, I mean, last year alone, 2016, was probably one of the bloodiest years Turkey has had. I mean, after the failed coup, the amount of bombings and shootings that took place, it was phenomenal.
Well, Ben's dad was caught at the airport when they had that attack last year.
That was intense. That was crazy. That was ISIS. They came out, and there's a distinction between the two attacks. So basically, the PKK terror group, they will attack the police. They will go directly for the police. They do their suicide bombings, their car bombings, and that's what they, you know, RPGs, that's what they do. Then you get ISIS. ISIS doesn't care who you are. They don't care whether you got kids or where you're from, or they got no feeling. They just want to send a message.
Good old terror group.
And it's like hardcore. They'll go and they'll do the airport attack. Or they'll go into a nightclub and start shooting people celebrating New Year's. You know, so that's their mindset, and that's what they do. So that is more scary than the PKK. With the PKK, you know, at least, okay, fine, the tourist spots are fine.
They just want to, their beef is with the state.
Exactly. Right. Trying to get the independence, etc. So there's a...
ISIS's beef is with everybody.
Exactly.
No.
You know, so yeah, so that's basically it. I mean, the last one was the before the New Year's Eve one. We were watching the Man City-Leicester game, the one evening where Leicester ate Man City. And we switched off the TV and we were just relaxing. I was talking to my kids. And I had my balcony door open, but this is like midwinter, right, in December. And I was having a bit of a smoke, and out of the blue, this massive bang. We all just stared at each other. My kids looked at me. Dad, I think that's a bomb. Got off onto the balcony. All my neighbors, across buildings, side buildings, everybody's out on the balconies. We're all looking around. I jumped onto a work group. I seen the Besiktas stadium bombing.
Yes.
Happened right now. Not even a few seconds later, in the distance, I could see that it's 3 kilometers from where we live.
Yeah.
We heard the gunshots, and we seen the second explosion.
God.
The fire go up in the air. You know, and I had my kids looking at it, and everybody's like, whoa, what's going on? And that was basically a PKK terror attack, the double bombing. So it's insane. I mean, you know, it's very strange, you know, a South African who's been very, very cautious all the time, locking his car door, making sure he doesn't drive late at night. That's our mindset here in this country, because that's our worst that we can experience. You understand? A hijacking or a shooting or an armed robbery or home invasion or something.
There's
no way
to protect yourself against this.
You cannot. My father tells me, son, you know what? Take care of yourself. Look after yourself. I'm like, Dad, but how do I do that?
You can't.
I can't go to a mall. We walked to a mall, the Javair Mall in Shishli. And when we walked out, there was a massive protest against government by the opposition party right outside the mall. And the cops started shooting with tear gas canisters. And I had my kids with me. They were coughing. They were like, Dad, what's going on? I held them. We tried to get back into the mall. The mall, the security said, no, we're closed. We're shutting this mall down. So we were out there in the middle. We managed to make our way around the mall. You know, the person that I am, you know, you know what to do, exit strategies, whatever it may be. And we managed to get to a side road, but the taxis didn't want to go anywhere. We had no transport. Nobody wanted to go anywhere. They were stuck. They said, no, we're not driving. It's too dangerous. The cops are starting to shoot.
And now you got red eyes and the kids are crying.
Like, what do you do in a situation like that? You know, first time a 9 and 10 year old are experiencing tear gas. They're experiencing a whole lot of stuff around you. But, we managed to get a taxi.
That's where your children should be taken away from you, because you're a terrible parent.
The elephant in the room is finally discussed.
No, I mean, I'm fascinated by the fact that this is also the place where immigration is the number one story, and not just because it's a big political hot potato like it is in America. This is actually where it's happening. So people who are leaving Syria in their droves, I mean, Syria's emptied.
Right. So we're
coming mostly through Turkey.
100%. We discuss one side of the coin, right? So that's the dangers in that aspect of Turkey. Then the other side of the coin. You ask me now whether I want to move back to South Africa. I'll tell you no. Not yet. You ask my kids, where do you love it more, in Turkey or South Africa? They'll tell you, we love Turkey first, then Cape Town, then Durban. They don't mention Joburg. They don't like it. No, it's too boring here. There's nothing for us to do here. We got beaches in Turkey. We got malls. We got everything cool there. And Cape Town, because we lived there for the past 2 years before we moved to Turkey. So they love it there. And Durban, obviously, because my in-laws are there. So they love it there. That's their thing. But anyway, on the other
but
side of the
you,
coin...
for you, what's the reason to stay? Because of the work that you get to do?
No, not only
there?
The work. Gareth, the place is lovely. Yeah. You know, despite these bombings which happened...
I want to go. People are telling me not to go.
No, come. I promise you. My wife, let me tell you, I'll be chilling in my apartment. My wife at 11:30 at night. She's telling me, you know what? I'm up for an ice cream. What are you doing? Are you going to join me or I'll just take a walk?
Just walk on her own.
All right, cool. Go.
Jeez.
She walks downstairs, goes to the shop on the main road, grabs herself an ice cream, chats to the shop owner, chills out, takes the time, walks back, end of discussion, story. Closed. They know us in the community. We welcome the community. And it's safe in terms of crime. So that's what I'm saying. You can't understand it, because you're not going to get hijacked. This is the bank. Basically, Gareth the teller, I'm the client. There's nothing between us. I can touch
not
you.
Like South Africa where you've got glass and steel.
I can see all the money you got there and behind you stacked up, and no one's going to do anything. There's no hijackings. There's no armed robberies. There's nothing on that. The worst probably you'll get
is a little bit of ISIS.
Just a little.
That's what you're dealing with.
But again, your chances of being killed by them are very, very slim. I mean, it's, you know, worldwide. Yeah. And this is something people have got to come to terms with. I believe that there are a lot of problems with terrorism. Don't get me wrong. But in data terms, your likelihood of being killed by terrorists is very, very small. In America, in Turkey, in the only places where you really are in deep trouble is if you go into Syria or you go into Iraq. And even there, if you're in certain places, you're okay.
And you need crazy permissions to get there.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, we sent a correspondent into Syria. It took us 2 weeks
just to get
of negotiations between the Turkish government, Syrian government, to get permission, and they only gave us 4 days.
Yeah.
So we sent a cameraman and a correspondent to Idlib for 4 days, escorted by government. They went to Idlib, they covered the story, they did whatever they needed to do, and they got escorted back out. Mm. So you can't just walk into Syria. Sure. There's no way, you can't. I mean, unless it's with permissions. The other side of the coin I was still talking to you about, and so it's safe, and you can go out at night, and you adhere to certain warnings, you monitor certain websites, consulates, mm-hmm. embassies, listen, stay away from Taksim this weekend, there's a lot of activity, so you're not going to go there. You know, you can go to the Blue Mosque area, there's four seas that are around Turkey. You've got the Black Sea above it that separates it from Russia, right. You've got the Mediterranean Sea at the bottom, you've got the Aegean Sea, the Marmara, and the Marmara Sea, which links the Black Sea and the Marmara with the Bosphorus. Mm-hmm. So we've got four seas, and so it's you're not short of options for entertainment. You can go to the beaches, you can go for fishing, you can go for ferry rides, boat rides. I mean, we had some family come over, my wife's sister and them came over the last week of December, first week of January, and I took them to a ski resort in Bursa, which is
Turkish tourism update is brought
to
you.
It's unbelievable. No, but honestly, it's like unbelievable.
I want to go.
And people don't understand this. And you know, you come there, you just adhere to the warnings. That's it. Stay away from certain places.
I'm going to go, but I'm going to need you to help me figure it out.
Of course, man. I'll take you all the places. So the refugees,
tell me about the refugees.
So around 1.5 million refugees are being taken care of by the Turkish government at the moment. They're pumping a lot of money into this. They're giving citizenship to those who will be able to help the country, those with degrees, those with qualifications, and they're giving them citizenship.
Yes.
Because obviously they'll be useful to society and to the workforce. There's a problem at the moment with regards to the agreements between Turkey and the European Union, because initially it was, listen, we're going to take over so much, and we'll pay you to take over the rest, you know, to help the rest. Mm-hmm. That whole thing has fall through, and now the whole thing's sitting on Turkey's shoulders. So Turkey's continuing doing this, but it's you can see the effects in cities like Istanbul, Ankara, around, you know, where jobs are becoming more scarce. There's more. When I moved there last year, you would see maybe a beggar in a place like Taksim coming to you to ask you for money. Now that has increased. You'll see them even more in different places, you know, normal neighborhoods, walking around, Syrians with no place to stay, no, you know, nothing, whatever it may be. And you've seen the effects happening. Generally, the Turkish people, this is what my personal experience, they've got the certain type of animosity towards the Arabs. You don't blame them, but they don't like the Arab nations.
Let's just be clear about this, because a lot of people don't know about these very distinct differences. Just like Iranians are not Arabs on that far end, Turks don't consider themselves Arabs. They're not. But they're not of the same kind of family tree.
Nothing at all. Yeah, no links at all.
And a lot of people go, well, there's Islam there, they must all be Arabs.
No. There's Islam, yeah, we are not an Arab.
No, absolutely. Let's just make this clear to people, because like you get Persians or Iranians, you get Turks, they are not Arabs, and Arabs are not Iranians and Turks. They're very different people, and the Turks actually have a very fractious relationship with the Saudis in particular. They don't really get along. They get along with, to a degree, Syria, Jordan, but not so much the others.
Not so much the others. I think the main reason is because of the extravagance shown by those wealthy nations, where they haven't really put their foot down to assist these refugees.
Not a single Syrian refugee has gone to Bahrain,
nothing.
Oman, Saudi Arabia,
Doha, Qatar, you know,
not,
UAE.
They won't take one Syrian.
And they concentrating. So the Turks are like, you know what, guys?
Screw you.
Exactly. No. So it's built up. It's been building up for quite a while, and they've got this animosity towards. So I'm an Indian. I'm South African. You know this. I know this. But the Turks don't know this. They look at me and they see Arab.
Do they? They think you're an Arab.
They see Arab. They look at my wife. They see Arab. Uh-oh. You know, they don't know anything about where we come from, where I was born, nothing.
But they're quite a diverse nation. So they're not like hostile.
No.
But they're suspicious.
Well, so you can say there is this path of racism, so to speak. So, for example, what we'll experience, you know, just like your day-to-day living, you jump onto a bus,
mm-hmm.
And I go to work and I sit on the bus and the bus will be full and I'll have a seat next to me, but no one would want to sit next to me.
Are you wearing anything in particular? Are you wearing civvies? Normal. Like your t-shirt and jeans?
That's it. Normal. Nothing.
There's because that is racism.
No, 100%. And I mean, I had an incident when I just moved there.
Arab-Turkish racism. You see it here.
It happens
on every... Oh, my God.
They've got this word, which I didn't know, and I found out later what it actually meant. So I've got a barber downstairs near my apartment. And I went to, when I just moved there, I needed a haircut. So I said, okay, fine, this is convenient. The guy's right down. So I walked in. I walk in and he looks at me. I'm like, you know, I couldn't speak Turkish. I couldn't speak a single word of Turkish. So I was using my Google app, you know, to translate app guy, you know, can you cut my hair? He looks at me. He's like, Arab yok, peace. I'm like, what is this guy telling me? Like, okay, Arab, right, fine, yok, Arab, that means no. So he's telling me Arab, no. Oh, all right, okay. So I was like, you know, I'm Arab, no. I'm not an Arab, you know. Gune Afrika, that means South Africa. Afrika, yok, sia yok. I'm not black, right? So I translated it. I'm taking my time trying to figure out what's going on here.
You want a goddamn haircut.
Exactly.
You don't want to have an argument about
it. I mean, the guy's empty. He's just
anthropology
there
with this dude.
Exactly. Yeah. Eventually, I realized what was happening. I pulled off my driver's license.
Mm.
And I showed it to him, South Africa. And I said, look, Gunai Afrika. He looks at it, he just looks, oh, Afrika, Gunai Afrika.
Then he's prepared pictures. To cut your hair.
He looks at me, oh, Gunai Afrika, Mandela. Oh, Meraba. And he puts me down in the seat. He's like, want to massage me?
I'm
like,
no. Now you're his best friend.
I'm done. You know what, my man? Enjoy your barber. I ain't going to cut you again. So I did the translation of racist and I showed it to him, you know. it's your kick, you know. So I showed it to him and I'm like, you, it's your kick, you know. So he looks at me, no, yo. Then I find out, a few weeks later, pis means filthy.
Oh.
So this is the word that a lot of people use against Arabs, you know, when they see certain Arabs and they're like, no, pis. It means that they're filthy. So that's how they look at them. Well, these Arab nations. You know, so then you kind of start.
I should remember that word when we have guests that I don't like. Peace. Yok.
Yeah, that means no. So, so basically, you know, then we started living with it. I mean, I grew up in a part of South Africa. Dory must have told you I was born in Alexandra Township. So we had it rough.
Oh, you were born in Alex?
Yeah, we were born in Alex. My dad was born in Alex. His brothers were born in Alex. The entire family, we from Alexandra, First Avenue, 195, First Avenue.
How did that happen? How did Indian families end up in Alex?
No, this is Group Areas Act. We didn't want to move to an Indian area. We stayed where we were. My grandfather, at the age of 14, was working on a farm in Rivonia, and then he got a job at a shop in Alexandra.
Yeah.
So he moved to Alexandra. He was on his own. He came to South Africa at the age of like 12.
Yeah.
So he came and eventually got a job in Alexandra, and he started working there. And he worked there for a few years. He got married in India. He brought my grandmother over, and they just settled there, and that was it. A lot of Indian
that
families.
That was your hood,
it.
Huh?
That was my hood. I used to ride bike down to 19th Avenue, come back up again. I mean, during the xenophobia, I was basically navigating through. Everyone was behind me. And I was like, okay, we got to go here. This is where it's happening. This is where the hostels are. This is where this is. So, you know, because that was where I grew up. So I experienced racism. I experienced cops raiding the Indian homes when I was like 4 years old, 5 years old. These guys picking me up and smacking me around, vasio pa, you know, that type of thing. And now I look at this situation and like it's like a whole, like almost like a reverse, like, okay, it's happening all over again where these people don't want to even the taxi driver will stop. Oh, no, Arab, and he'll drive away.
But now, so do you feel that the same kind of thing is happening to Muslims? You can't call it racism because Islam is not a race. It's a religion. It's an ideology. Do you feel, and especially in the light of what you hear from Donald Trump and from, you know, from various groups all over Europe too, that there is this Islamophobia going on?
Look, on my side personally, I've never been subjected to any form of Islamophobia. I've traveled. Last year, in fact, we went to the UK. We flew KLM. We had an option to fly via Paris to the UK or via Amsterdam. I chose Amsterdam.
Okay.
Because I know what's Paris all about when it comes to Islamophobia. So I didn't want to subject my wife to
Is Paris like that? It's hectic?
A lot of my colleagues have told me that they were subjected. You know, they pull you out of the queues. They'll give you like the special X-ray thing, and, you know. And
glove, hand up the backside, you know, all that
whole
stuff.
Thing. So I was like, you know what? Islam's
if you've got a name like Abed Ahmed, it's not going to go well.
There you go. You know what I'm saying? So... And plus with the beard, you know, it's like, oh, here we go, man. This guy, 25C. Okay, we're just going to watch him there. Amsterdam, second highest religion in the Netherlands, Islam.
Yeah.
So that's why I chose, it's like, okay, fine. I walk into the airport, I just see Muslim people.
Yeah.
Like, okay, fine. Muslim security guys, group five security. Yeah, these guys, no, it's fine. Come through. Okay. The reason why, the only reason which I agree with is whenever flights come in from Turkey around the world, people tend to get a bit more secure because of the people coming out of Turkey and going into Turkey because right. there's been a trend where people are going to join ISIS or coming back out,
sure.
you know, to their countries. So extra precaution, no problem.
Including crazy teenage Western girls.
You know what I'm saying? So we'll adhere to that security, we'll go through. Not once was my wife asked to remove her hijab. Not once was I ever, you know, pulled aside and saying, listen, take off your clothes or your shoes.
Yeah.
I didn't even take off my shoes. So I just walked through the X-ray thing, you know, we walked through and it was all good, you know, just smooth sailing. So personally, I've never experienced anything and I hope I don't ever have to come to a point where I experience anything. Comments, definitely. You get it all the time. We used to.
Everybody gets something.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, you thick sure. skin, you know, you just move on. You're not going
to... But there's a difference. There is a distinct difference here between racism of the kind you were describing earlier, whether it was here in South Africa or what you got in Turkey. And... Islamophobia.
Yes, 100%.
I mean, it's a very different thing. And people can't conflate them because often people on the left throw them together and they do both a disservice.
Yeah. No, no. I mean, racism exists around the world.
Mm.
Religious discrimination exists around the world sure. as well. I mean, anti-Semitism. I mean, I've seen it in my own neighborhood where I know Jewish people who live there. There's a synagogue there where I live. There's a church where I live. And I've seen Jewish people get discriminated against, you know. Funny enough, the Arabs who come in as tourists, and you know they'll walk past a synagogue and they'll spit or something on that side. It's stupid. I mean, why even go down that route? You respect Islam's religion of peace. You respect all other people. You respect religion. It's about building character. It's about creating community, and it's about building trust with people around you, and you know being a good person. Ultimately, that's it. I mean, what's happening now is that they've ISIS have completely destroyed the image of Islam around the world. They're not even Muslim.
They're not doing anyone a favor.
They're not even Muslim. They don't face Mecca when they're praying.
They will say that they're the best Muslims.
No, in yeah. I promise
But they'll,
you.
They'll tell you they are.
They can say whatever they want to say. I mean, there's a lot of people who I mean, large majority of us who completely disagree. You don't see us.
But this isn't even an argument. I mean, you know, it irritates me when people say to me, oh, you know, there are a billion Muslims in the world. The majority of these people are peaceful and they mean well. Of course, it goes without saying. It's a stupid argument to even have any other point of view on that. But that's not the important issue here. It's that the PR at the moment is not very good.
No, it isn't.
And the PR is not helping good Muslims to just get on with their lives. Now, I don't know, would you classify yourself as one of these moderate Muslims? Because that's what everybody's talking about now.
What do you see?
I just see a person.
Exactly. I'm a conservative Muslim. I'm a conservative practicing Muslim. A Muslim's supposed to be practicing. You practice. You've got to pray five times. It's obligatory to pray five times a day.
The things you've got to do.
And exactly. So I look at myself as not...
Charity.
Exactly.
Hajj.
I carry out all my five pillars. I do what I need to do. What's required of me. My wife does what's required of her. And we're teaching our kids this way as well. So, I mean, I don't believe in liberal Islam. I don't believe in modern Islam. I believe in Islam. Islam is one... It means peace, and that's it. It's one concept. You can't take it and look at Judaism. Beautiful religion, very close to Islam. A lot of the beliefs, the Torah, everything, you know.
Christianity, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, they're all copied and pasted from each other.
So there's a lot of similarities, you know, with the prophets from back in the day.
What about this fear about Sharia law?
Sharia law is what's stated in the Quran and the Hadith. You can live if you can manage personally. I will not be able to live under Sharia law. I'm a conservative practicing Muslim. Sharia law is difficult. it's extremely difficult to live under. You have to be on a certain
level.
There
are parts of it that are just not compatible with Western civilization.
But as I'm saying, is that you cannot bring a religion which is 1,400 years or 2,000 years old and try and contextualize it and bring it into modern society. Look at Judaism.
But then something's got to, the Holy See. Something's got to give, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, the Christians were tamed by the Enlightenment. They were told, you're not allowed to just burn witches. You're not allowed to execute these homosexuals. You're not allowed to murder adulterers. You're not allowed to stone your daughter if she's unvirtuous. They were tamed. Yeah. The Christians were told, you cannot behave like this anymore. And the Catholic Church and all the other churches started to gradually lose their power on civilization. Secularism was on the rise. Exactly. You live in a secular country in Turkey. They don't have Sharia law there.
There is no Sharia law there.
And people live mostly in relative harmony with each other.
Of course, 100%. I mean,
but can you imagine if there were people in Germany, France, Britain, America who wanted Sharia law? It's completely incompatible with the laws of those countries.
No, 100%. I mean, look, I mean, inevitably, the message of whether it's ISIS or wherever it may be, they want to bring out the proper hardcore version, not the tamed down version. Look at Saudi Arabia.
It's Wahhabi Islam.
It's distorting the entire religion of Islam.
And
basically,
it's basically political in nature.
100%.
Those imams and mullahs are the ones who
they
want.
They pick and choose,
and they're also in cahoots with the royal family there in order to maintain power over the people.
100%.
So it's got very little to do with the actual practice or the written word of the religion.
Look, they've got a certain level of Sharia law in certain Arab countries, but it's a tamed down version. You mentioned it. I mean, like, you're not going to hear of people who are engaged in a homosexual act getting sentenced to death. You're going to hear them getting maybe lashes, which is a tamed down version because Islam calls for people.
But even
do you know
so,
what I'm saying?
I mean, even so would you want to see that? I wouldn't.
No, I personally, from my own personal perspective, I am too weak to live under Sharia law. As a Muslim, I got to be a very high...
I would say too sensible.
Exactly.
I wouldn't say too weak.
Well, you know what I'm saying? It's whichever way you look at it. But anyway, yeah, that's on that. But, I mean, moving back to Turkey, I mean, you have to come, getting back to your question. Seriously, Gareth, there is so much to do, so much to see, so much history in this country that and so much of beauty.
How long are you here for?
We're flying back out on Saturday.
Well, listen, keep us updated. Can we call you up in Turkey if things happen, find out what's going on?
Yeah, definitely. You can just give us a call.
Like
we'll discuss
our
it with
Turkish correspondent.
Yeah, I do a lot of that.
Awesome. Yeah, this is good. Yeah. Well, listen, man, it's good to meet you. And thank you for telling us about Turkey. I do want to go. I meant to go. And then someone said to me, oh, no, you can't go now. It's much too dangerous.
Look, I mean, there's at the moment, the tourists from Europe, there's a large rise. A lot of
really?
People. Yeah, unbelievable. Antalya was fully
crazy
booked.
Europeans.
We went to the ski resort. It was completely booked out. We
now,
just
where do you ski? In the Caucasus Mountains?
No, it's 2 hours away from Istanbul in
You're
Bursa.
Joking.
Uludag Mountains. The Uludag, Uludag, 2 hour ferry ride, jump onto the ferry in Istanbul from outside the Besiktas Stadium.
Well, you've basically
you
got a Mediterranean climate, and then within a couple of minutes, you're in snow.
It's unbelievable. The Mediterranean climate's more on the south of the country.
Right.
Istanbul's on the west of the country, which is very near to Europe.
Right.
So this is Bursa, Uludag, this is more towards the west of the country.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. There are ski resorts like 2 hours away. There's beaches like an hour away. You got a choice. You can go to the Black Sea if you want to go and swim. You can go to the Marmaras. You can go to the Aegean. I'm a fisherman. I love fishing. So I move around Mediterranean. If I'm feeling for tropical climate, if I'm feeling for this climate, I go up to the Black Sea. You know, so you can, how cool is this? You can jump onto a ferry if you got a Schengen visa, and you can take a ferry to Ukraine.
This tourism update was brought to you by the Turkish government. No, listen, this has been terrific.
Noel, you asked me, so I mean, this is basically the beauty part of this.
You've told me a lot.
I
can't believe we've run out of time because I would have spoken to you even longer. Thank you, Abed. Very, very big pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure is always.
And we'll speak to you again soon.
Yeah, I hope we do this more often.
Cool, man. And just look after those family members of yours back in Istanbul.
9 and 10 year olds. I mean,
no, they're happy. Seriously, they're happy.
I know, yeah. I know. I'm not saying they're not happy.
They're pretty much happy. So,
like your father said, look after yourself. And you're like, how the hell am I going to do that?
Exactly.
All right, very good. Thank you so much, Abed Ahmed. And we'll talk to him again when he's back in Istanbul. But that's fascinating. I mean, I didn't know some of these things about Turkey. Did you?
No.
Hell no. CliffCentral.com.